Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today by Jonas Crossland, our property writer. How are you doing, Jonas?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Ian Smith, the deputy companies editor. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm spectacular. How are you doing, John?
I'm all right. And over in the control room, Graham Davis.
Hello, John.
Hello. And Dominic Toms.
Hello.
Yeah, Dom, I've been told by one listener that we want to hear more from you, so might bring you in at some point.
Tottenham
Hotspur related questions. Cool. Okay, right, so this weekend, it's a spectacular weekend of sport. The Ashes, the Open is going on, but I know all you diehard investment fans will be shunning that for our spectacular podcast instead, where all the action happens. And of course, this week, you know, there has been lots of action on the stock market, as usual. Greece, we thought it was all over. It isn't.
No.
Or is it?
Oh, I
can't keep up. I think it is now. The Greek Parliament voted, didn't they, in favour of the latest bailout conditions?
Did you see there was a very stormy session in Parliament over there yesterday? It all kicked off a little bit, but yeah, they pushed it through.
Well, I was listening to it.
They voted to agree to start negotiations on the bailout. So
right.
But just before they voted, the IMF came out and said that the deal won't actually work unless there's a solid amount of debt relief in it.
Well, no. Because, if you look at the conditions of the bailout, I mean, there is no way an economy can grow out of that.
Yeah.
It's insane. So, yes, there was a stormy session. I was listening to it live, in fact, on Radio 5 driving home last night.
Yeah.
Apparently, the speaker walked out. The speaker of the Greek Parliament walked out.
Did you see one of the members of Parliament tearing up the pieces of paper?
Were they?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So, yeah, perhaps we should talk about that a little bit.
Mm.
But... Yeah, so this week we're going to talk to Jonas in a minute about property. Jonas has written the cover feature, which is about investing in London. Obviously, London's had a few boom years, and you know, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the best days were behind it. Not necessarily the case. We'll come on to that in a minute. And a couple of other things Jonas has written on some of the budget changes around the property sector. But, let's focus on this week's news. Graham, what's been going on in the world at large? 7 days. What have the last 7 days brought us?
Well, you know, it's been a geopolitical week, I think, John. We touched upon Greece already briefly. And then, obviously, there's been Chinese GDP figures. But also, you know, a big piece of news in the world politics is the deal with Iran.
Oh, yes.
Over their nuclear ambitions and reining them in a little bit.
Whether they had any in the first place.
Well, indeed, they would argue not.
In terms of
building a nuclear bomb.
The Iranians have always contended that their nuclear program is for domestic energy production.
But there's only one country that wouldn't agree with that, and they've obviously been strongly objecting to this deal, Israel,
yes,
a neighbour. But yeah, I mean, and there's obviously some elements within the US that aren't particularly keen on doing any deals with Iran either. I mean, it's been the subject of sanctions for many years. But yeah, this is potentially revolutionary. Excusing the pun.
Potentially massive. There were some figures from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, saying that Iran's economy would be the size of Saudi Arabia's now if it hadn't been for the impact of sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
So for that country, it's no surprise that there have been people dancing in the streets to welcome this. So if there are any hardliners derailing the deal, I would argue it's probably more likely to be from the US side. So Obama has got a bit of a job ahead of him selling this deal to the US Congress. You know, it's not many years ago that you had senators saying bomb, bomb, bomb Iran.
Yes, and of course Israel's voice is very strong within the US as well. So
their
position is not one to be taken lightly. They're not keen.
Obama has vowed to use his presidential veto to get this one thing through. I think you get the impression if there's one thing he actually achieves between now and the end of his presidency, it's this.
It's a good thing. It feels it has the kind of momentousness of something like, you know, Nixon's deal with China, you know, the opening up of Russia back in the 80s, 90s. I mean, this feels big.
Yeah, and I think even for the pragmatists within the policymakers, in terms of looking for stabilizing forces within that region, Iran is going to have been increasingly viewed as kind of one of the more stable and more predictable of the state actors within the region. So even for the people that, you know, don't have much love for the country, I think there's probably an emerging pragmatism towards Iran and the role that it plays.
It's a big country. And I've got friends who are of Iranian descent, and they've been back there. And, you know, of course, it is subject to some slightly strange, from our perspective, religious oversight. But nevertheless, there are other elements of it which are quite capitalist in nature.
Yeah, and I went to Iran kind of 8-9 years ago. Lots of sides of the society, particularly within Tehran, there's a big westernized kind of part of the society that like the similar kind of fashion and similar kind of things to what you see on British high streets. So it also, on the company side of thing, opened up some interesting avenues for UK and Western companies to access that market.
It's another big market to go after. I mean, presumably there's some talented people in that country as well. You know, companies from Iran that we might start to see, you know, on the global stage, like we've seen from other countries as they've, you know, emerged from sort of very developing status. So, I mean, this feels good.
And
this feels good.
Iran has the world's fourth largest proven oil reserve.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Massive. I mean, that is potentially game-changing for the global oil market as well. If those reserves are freed up and sanctions are lifted on the sale of them. It's a huge actor in the global petroleum.
They've also got about $65 billion of assets frozen, so it'll be interesting to see what happens to those as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this feels like it's certainly a counterbalance to some of the sort of strife we're seeing in Greece, for example, and obviously the sort of slowdown in China. And stock market problems. I say slow down in China, 7% again.
Yeah,
Graham.
Surprise, surprise.
We had a chuckle about that.
We did. China is aiming for 7% GDP growth this year, and lo and behold, second quarter, 7% growth.
Doesn't
amazing.
Doesn't feel right.
Doesn't quite, does it?
No.
But I mean, there was some theory that actually a lot of this quarter's growth was boosted by the stock market rally. People feeling a bit more flush because their shares were going up. So we could see it. I'm not saying I believe these figures and that they're definitely genuine, but I'm saying that there's a good chance that the economy may have been boosted in recent months, and that effect could disappear now.
Oh, it's going to disappear very quickly because as we spoke about last week, you know, the stock market there lost 30% of its value in the course of about 5 days.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of that wealth effect, I think, is it's going to disappear. I'm still troubled by that situation. There was a bit of a bounce back over a couple of days this week, and then it all sort of fell out of bed again.
Funnily enough, the GDP figures sent the stock markets falling again.
Is that a coincidence? Or
it may be coincidence. It may be that people are thinking, oh, the stimulus that has been in place the last few months is working, and it might get pulled back a bit. I really don't know. As you know, China's incredibly difficult to call. Really,
you also had some strong words from BlackRock today, criticising the government intervention in the market. So obviously, BlackRock, one of the world's biggest money managers. Mm. If you start to lose those kind of investors, not good for your stock market.
Yeah, I think that's been the consensus view on the government's intervention in the stock market tumble. I mean, this is immature.
They've created a false market.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I think that I read a really interesting piece, and I can't remember who wrote it now, and I do apologise to whoever did, but they said, you know, China, which seems so level-headed in everything else it seems to be doing, you know, the stock market starts to crash and it panics. Mm. It really panics in an extraordinary way. I've never seen anything like it.
No, it's incredible, really.
Yeah, back to Iran. Yeah, it does feel like we needed a good geopolitical story to offset some of the bad ones that we're kind of seeing from China and Greece. Do we got any more to say about Greece? Not really.
Just a bit more today, post the vote last night. I think there's been some bridging finance has now been forwarded to Greece, so that, you know, the initial pressure is off. And Mario Draghi's been having his press conference this afternoon from the ECB, and he has hinted at that there will be some within the talks now that Greece has agreed that there could be some potential talk of debt relief.
Right.
And they've reopened the emergency liquidity assistance, haven't they, to Greece?
So, the taps have been reopened a little bit. It's still a mess.
But the scenario where Greece lost access to funding, you know, was pretty catastrophic. Mm. I mean, you know, you'd have people not being paid, you'd have, you know, finding it difficult to import basic necessities. I mean, it was, you know, it was Armageddon, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Financial Armageddon. Yeah. So, yeah, something that needs to happen. I get the sense now that the finger pointing is now actually spreading throughout, you know, the more stable members of the European bloc, you know, Germany and France, and they're all starting to blame each other for what's been going on, or, you know, Angela Merkel's being criticised for heaping pressure on the Greeks or for intimidating the Greeks, I think they said. I mean,
I don't feel
like a harmonious.
I don't think the EU comes out of this smelling of roses by any stretch. I think, you know, they've been seen to have really sort of put the pressure on Greece and kept the pressure on even when Greece was really suffering.
And especially the expectations for growth in the Greek economy that are built into this package. You know, even the IMF has said, you know, these are a stretch at best.
Mm.
So, you know, I know we long predicted it would be a fudge. I don't want to kind of use that stronger word, but I mean, you know, it's hard to see how Greece is going to live up to this package, even if it kind of enacts the reforms as requested. It still might not be enough.
Yeah. It's almost as if somebody wants them to fail, Ian.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
We don't do conspiracies here. Okay, let's talk interest rates, because as soon as Greece seemed to be in the rearview mirror, the chatter started about interest rate rises again, helped along by Bank of England Governor Mark Carney's appearance at the Treasury Select Committee.
Indeed, and Janet Yellen's appearance in front of senators and legislators in the US as well.
Yeah.
So the chatter's rising, I think.
So rate rise are on the way then?
Apparently.
Bang on for this year.
Yeah. We've heard that before.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And as you wrote, John, we had kind of US retail sales that slipped. Mm. They were predicted to rise. They actually shrank. And we had some kind of UK economic data that was a bit patchy.
Well, unemployment. Mm. Unemployment rose again.
Rose, but also wages rose as well. So people have been kind of trying to work out that puzzle.
And that's a correlation that's flipped completely. Mm. For a long, long time, we've had unemployment falling, but wages not growing, and that suddenly the correlation's flipped.
And it could be this productivity conundrum, you know, unwinding itself, but it's quite early to say.
But we also had inflation nipping down again back to zero.
Zero,
I think
yep.
it was. The last May, was that May's figures or June's figures?
It was June.
June, was it? Okay. Yeah.
And with this Iran oil flooding onto the market, you know, that's keeping the oil price down.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there's not really, I mean, the wage pressure, the rising wages are the argument that they're giving, the employment figures, they're the arguments that Yellen and Carney are reading out to suggest that, you know, rate rises are on the way. But you know, it doesn't feel like there's any other pressure that's really behind that. And, you know, my view, my take on this is that, well, you know, the whole forward guidance thing, I mean, we've been kind of hearing this for a while. Yeah, rate rises around the corner. Earlier in the year, you know, we thought that they were on the way and the house builders got hit, which you obviously paid attention to at that point.
Yeah.
And it's happened again.
Yeah, I mean, part of the thing here is I think that inflation to some extent has been driven by external factors like oil prices. Now, later this year, those factors will fall out of the equation. So you'll see inflation tick up again.
Yeah, but it's still miles away from anything that we need to worry about. 2% target, miles away
from exactly,
that.
Well, exactly, yes. I can't see interest rates going up in the UK at least for another year.
So going back to the house builders, which I mentioned in my editorial, which you cover, Jonas.
Yeah.
This little fall that we've seen this week as a result of this latest round of speculation on interest rate rises, not too bothered.
No. I mean, there's various aspects. I mean, the house builders are very much like the property scene is deeply and strictly correlated with economic growth. If the economy is healthy, house builders will be okay, especially since the demand-supply imbalance. It's interesting because during the recession, when everyone was hit, the demand for housing didn't go away because people were growing up, leaving home, etc., etc. Now that the economy is back on its feet, that demand is still there, and in fact there's a backlog, but the house builders just can't hope to cover that gap.
Yeah, so you actually wrote a piece this week on one potential measure which could alleviate some of the pressure on housing stock, which was the measures around brownfield planning.
Yeah, the trouble is that local authorities have got a problem because apart from local interests that preclude you building houses next door to people who don't want them there, there's also the planning process, which is suffering because the planning departments are severely under-resourced.
Mm.
They can't process more anyway. So finding them for not clearing planning applications in time is not going to sort it out. There's a suggestion that house builders or the government could actually create some sort of funding to help this along its way. It doesn't sound like a good idea as far as house builders are concerned, but if it means that they can get a planning process cleared in 6 months instead of 6 years, it will certainly be to their advantage.
Do they want to increase the supply, or does the status quo whereby, you know, supply can be limited because of the planning constraints, you know, it kind of helps them with pricing? I mean, what do they want? What would they prefer?
Well, it's a bit naughty because new house build doesn't dictate prices. What the house builders do is they basically track what's happening in the already built market. So if already built houses are going up 10% a year, they'll be quite happy to shove up new build prices for 8%, by 8%. And the worry is for them is that if they doubled production, which they obviously couldn't, the supply-demand imbalance would be cured, and so obviously upward pressure on prices would diminish.
Mm.
And basically they don't want to sell houses for level prices, especially at a time when cost inflation, mainly bricklayers and people like that, they're going up 3-4% a year.
Well, that sounds like a case for improving the apprentice schemes of the UK. And I know some of the building companies are involved in this kind of thing, but you know, we're often, you know, talking about, you know, how poor the prospects are for the young, and yet we've got this great big industry that's lacking skills. Yeah. It's a no-brainer, yeah. Surely.
Well, exactly. I mean, they've tried to sort of make bricklaying and surveying and things like that a little bit more sexy, rather than sort of going into tech. But you know, you're talking sort of 200, 300, 400, 500 apprenticeships when you need 200, 300, 400, 500,000.
Yeah.
So that side of things will improve over time, but not yet.
Well, I have to say, you know, if you don't think building control or engineering is sexy, I've spent £4,000 so far on my loft conversion. I haven't laid a brick.
Yeah, exactly.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. Extraordinary. I think, you know, good business to get in. I do sometimes wish I could rewind my life and go into higher building. It's Or installing boilers. That's quite that's not cheap.
You can go to university and get a 2.2 in English with media studies, or you can take an apprenticeship and become a plumber.
Yeah, yeah. I know what I'd be advising my kids to do.
Quite.
Plumbing girls.
Yeah. Well, girl plumbers, who cares?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, housing. We'll come back to London in a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, while we're on the subject of housing, you wrote the piece on the buy-to-let changes in the budget, because that has potentially nasty tax implications for buy-to-let landlords.
Yes.
Now, is this, I mean, presumably designed to put the brake on the buy-to-let market?
I think it's a tactic designed to raise money.
That's it.
Yeah.
So they don't care about the philosophical argument about, you know, new housing going to landlords rather than owners.
They haven't really thought it through. If they think that by making it less attractive to become a landlord, you're going to restrict the number of rental properties, and that's going to mess up the system even more.
Mm.
Okay, it's a long time coming, but I suppose if you're getting a 6, 5, 9, 11, depends where you invest in interest rate or yield, having that trimmed a little bit is not going to really hurt.
Yeah, and I think your suggestion was that, you know, if landlords are whacked by a little bit extra tax, they'll simply just put their rent up.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a collective judgment, you know. Obviously, if one landlord puts his prices, his rental up, all the others will follow. So, yeah, it's a done deal. It's arguable how much the market will take, but once you percolate all the other bits and pieces, I mean, landlords could set up companies, private companies, and in that case, they wouldn't have to pay interest rate charges, would be tax exempt or tax relievable. But obviously, setting up a company is tricky.
But then there's other tax implications of that around capital gains, that kind of thing as well.
Well, yeah, if you go from 12 properties that you own and shove them into a company, you could incur capital gains tax, yes.
Yeah.
Which is messy.
Sounds complicated. Like, we've written about this lots of times before. So if you go back through our archive, I'm sure you'll find something that will help you out to to navigate this minefield. You've put some case studies together, or you dug up some case studies to show how you manage, how the tax affects you, which I think that's quite useful if you're in a landlord in that situation.
I think if you're a low income, well, some people don't have any income at all, apart from, say, a pension or an old state pension. And if they got one little flat somewhere, it won't affect them.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting in the context of the reforms to the pension landscape. And we saw some figures around that this week, which I thought were quite interesting. The withdrawals from pensions, the $1 billion worth of withdrawals, the $800 million that have come out of income drawdown arrangements. So, I mean, it does sound like they're starting to filter through those changes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as expected, income drawdown is taking a bigger and bigger share of the market away from annuities. So in the past, back in 2012, I think when annuities are in their prime, they would take by the vast majority of the money that was going into income, as opposed to people just taking it as cash.
Yep.
But now income drawdown take an increasing amount of that. So it's great, as predicted, for all those players that are strong in that market.
And what are the withdrawals going into? The billion of withdrawals? I mean, is this people going out buying Lamborghinis? Or is this people buying buy-to-let properties?
Well, it's quite small amounts of money, so it's probably a lot of it's cash. Because, I mean, still for these reforms now, people, like the average defined contribution pension pot of retirement is quite small.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about these reforms is you've got to think 20, 30 years down the line, once the pension pots get big enough that you can do something a bit more interesting with them. And yeah, we've seen a lot of income drawdown too. But I would say a lot of the cash is at the smaller end. If you look at the figures, it suggests that, you know, it's a lot of people saying, well, it's not really much point, I might as well take it as cash.
Yeah.
So not quite a Lamborghini, perhaps. No. A second-hand car.
Yeah, the key attraction with income drawdown is that also when you die, you can pass it on to your family, whereas an annuity just goes up in smoke.
Yeah, or pays for other people's annuities who've lived a little bit longer.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Ian, before we return to the cover feature, kind of come back to you, Jonas. What's going on in companies? A bit quieter this week.
Yeah, it was a quiet week.
Kind of interesting things. I mean, International Personal Finance, which is one of yours, the international doorstep lender, has been having a bit of a hard time.
Yeah, they got hit in Poland, and we're talking before about credit in Poland. They've decided, the politicians in the lower chamber have voted to put kind of further caps on the interest rates that can be charged by doorstep lenders. So they've gone further than any of the regulators have here in the UK. The policymakers, I should say, here in the UK have gone. And that's really hit international personal finance. And so, yeah, the UK is a much better place to be lending to people with kind of subprime credit ratings.
Well, I mean, this comes actually back to the whole interest rate story because, you know, reading your piece, I thought it was fascinating. But I hadn't really cottoned on, I hadn't clocked how quickly personal household debt was rising in the UK.
Yeah, they think it's the highest for 5 years at the moment on the data. And it's absolutely fascinating. And companies such as SNU have really benefited from that. And I mentioned a company called Non-Standard Finance.
Which is Woodford's new thing.
It's the new thing that was kind of set up to buy smaller consumer credit players. And it bought SNU's consumer finance division, Loans at Home for You. And it's looking to kind of build through similar acquisitions. Yeah, it's a really interesting market. It's obviously, the companies are really benefiting from it. But, you know, as for what it says about the strength or otherwise of the UK economic recovery, if it's built on a lot of bad household debt, is another thing.
So, and that would, you know, lead you to the logical conclusion that if you put interest rates up, then there's going to be a lot of fallout if we are living in a debt-fueled economy.
Especially, yeah, exactly. So I would just say for these companies, they obviously stress test the growth of interest rates. And as you kind of argued in your editorial, it's hard to see them growing fast when they start to grow interest rates.
Yes.
So I think these companies are probably, you know, reasonably robust in terms of, you know, short to medium term modest rises in interest rates. But as we know, in the financial crisis, you know, when it goes wrong, it goes really wrong in terms of like building up a large amount of debt within an economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I noticed there were some figures from the CML today, like the Council of Mortgage Lenders. Mortgage lending has skyrocketed since the budget.
Yeah, gross lending has really taken off. It's probably not wise to put too much on that because that's gross lending and it's also not seasonally adjusted. So it could just be a post-election relief boom.
But we kind of expected the election result. Well, yeah. We didn't expect the election result. I think nobody expected the election result. But I think we expected, you know, once it was all over,
the results of the election result, yeah,
then there would be some thawing of the housing mortgage market. And I think, you know, the figures kind of back that view up.
Yeah. It's interesting because in the first 3 months of the year, when you think things would be a bit edgy, construction or new build rose significantly. So, although, you know, I suppose the newspapers said, you know, we're in for a sticky, tricky time, the house builders were busy building.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, my own view, I moved houses, I probably told you a million times before, in March. you know, there's virtually nothing on the market till then.
No.
And yeah, we got lucky, we found somewhere, we managed to get it all through in the end. And, you know, actually, but not a lot was shifting. But, you know, I, being the idiot that I am, still go back to Rightmove and see what's coming out to make sure I've not made a foolish error, which I don't seem to have done. But everything's sold and there's not a lot of second-hand supply coming onto the market.
No, that's absolutely right.
New build prices are astronomical, I would say, for what they are. It's amazing. OK, consumer debt, lovely. Lots of that keeps the economy moving along. Don't put up interest rates. It will have a disastrous effect, I'm sure. Talking of spending money, Supergroup had an interesting week. We've been brave on that one because we kind of looked like we got it horribly wrong when we tipped that, and it's come good.
Yeah, it had a really good week. I mean, I think after a sluggish first half, it really kind of roared back. It's one of those cases of blame the weather, man. Warm weather hit the sales of autumn winter clothing, but then some aggressive promotional activity in the second half brought the figures back. And it set its sights for a return to the US. It's also got a new clothing collection that's going to be modelled by British actor Idris Elba, aka Stringer Bell.
Stringer Bell.
That's his new gig.
He designed it. He designed the collection, according to this piece.
Oh, he designed
it. His design skills. Idris Elba's design skills, not his acting skills.
He's a multi-talented man. He's also a DJ, so he's got many different skills.
I like Idris Elba. You can't knock Idris Elba. But, you know, Supergroup, we're still keen on that.
Mm.
Conviviality, I thought, was quite interesting. I like this. It's bargain booze, yeah. Graham, you're going to a wine tasting, I hear.
Conviviality sent me an invitation to a wine tasting, in a couple of weeks' time with their master wine, apparently.
I don't want to, you know, disrespect Conviviality retail anyway, but I did not expect a bargain off-licence group to have a master of wine.
Well, no.
They have wine rack as well.
Ian made a good point. Yeah.
Okay.
I think they may have some. Yeah, and that's part of their growth story is that they've got a couple of different brands. So their franchisees can open up other kind of brands within the same area. Yeah, so, you know, that probably makes more sense that they have a master of wine. It's not just three bottles of wine for £10.
The bargain booze, three for a tenner.
Yeah, all right. Okay. Well, all right. It's
still going to be good stuff.
Could be a good night out.
More to conviviality than meets the eye. They're suspended at the moment, aren't they? They're about to buy something quite big. So I think, are they still suspended as we go to air? They were suspended at the time of writing.
I haven't checked today.
But nothing wrong with the company there. That's a technical matter.
Yeah, it's because they're going to do something that may constitute reverse takeover of Matthew Clark, which is half owned by Punch Taverns. Under the stock market rules, they have to suspend their shares.
Which is a wholesaler, which is interesting.
Mm.
Okay, technical matter. We still like that one.
Definitely.
Okay, let's talk London. Who doesn't love London?
Well, exactly.
But we're specifically talking property. And so, you know, we've had some astronomical rises in property values, certainly on the residential side of things in London. As I said earlier, you'd be forgiven for thinking it was game over, but you don't think so, Jonas?
No, well, it's an enormous market because, I mean, there's residential, commercial, office, retail. Stick your finger in and just say, well, retail, for argument's sake, especially in the West End, where most properties are listed or restricted. You can't just knock them down. So there's a very restricted supply. Tenants don't want to move out, so they're quite happy to punch up the rent.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Crossrail coming in, all-night tube trains. It's just a gravy train at the moment.
Yeah. And I mean, tourism here is absolutely huge. Yeah. I mean, we only have to walk out the door into Borough Market. I mean, if you can't move these days.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah.
Trying to get any lunch, he forces to go up to the canteen, which is a health hazard.
Well, that's side. The commercial side, well, you know, big slabs, big warehouses. These are really starting to move on because consumers have changed their habits. They want to sort of click on the computer, order something, and have it delivered at home within an hour. So you've got to have a massive warehouse inside the M25. Full of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's really driving the market for big blocks.
So we like things like Tritax Big Box REIT, which is in that space.
Yeah. I can't think of the other one. There's a couple that are really moving into that area. Yeah.
Funnily enough, I've actually bought something, for one of the first times, I bought something off the internet, off eBay, in fact, and I'm picking it up in an Argos. Up in Cheapside, which I think is quite interesting, the way the interplay between the big distribution and actually some of these online retail sites and the actual physical high street presence. So, I mean, I don't even think that's going away, even though it's perhaps not what it was. And actually, you talked about Shaftesbury in there. Shaftesbury being the West End property group that owns Chinatown, Seven Dials, Covent Garden. Anyway, that's fascinating because that's retail. At the upper scale. And you didn't, Ian, you went out and did the Shaftesbury Walk recently.
Yeah, I did the Shaftesbury Walk with Stephen Wilmot.
Have you done the Shaftesbury Walk?
Yeah, I'm going on another one in September.
I've done the Shaftesbury Walk. We've all done the Shaftesbury Walk.
Yeah.
So, was that your first time?
It was my first time. It was quite a walk. I had a video camera as well, so I don't think I managed to take it in quite the way.
But the reason us journalists always invite to go and do the Shaftesbury Walk is because, you know, when you see what they've got, you realise the value of it. And I think it's been a buy for us pretty much forever.
And you see the potential that they see in buildings. That's obviously their skill. And they've got a property just on the right by Chinatown, which is kind of a mixture of little shops and a car park at the moment. And they're going to kind of transform that and kind of create a lot more floor space. So it's all about their kind of vision for developing things within that area.
But this goes back to what you're saying about the lack of supply in the West End. You've got to reconfigure the buildings a bit more cleverly.
Yeah, and Shaftesbury works very closely with the local council, and they say, in sort of broad terms, you know, if you want planning consent to do this, it would help if you, you know, pedestrianise the street or put some nice lamps up and things like that. It's quite interesting because there's a Hong Kong investor, I can't remember his name, but he's just put out a tender offer to all the shareholders for 9% of Shaftesbury. He already owns about 3%, but the tender offer price is below the share price, so it'll probably go nowhere.
Mm.
But he obviously...
first early probing move.
Yeah, Shaftesbury's worth about $2.8 billion, and he's worth considerably less than that, so
might not go
anywhere.
Yeah, okay. I mean, Shaftesbury's a fascinating company. I mean, as I said, we've always been a big fan of that. Residential, you know, you'd think the game is up there, but the trend you pointed to that I thought was fascinating was, you know, the rise of high-rise residential. And we're seeing some of that at Canary Wharf at the moment. It's big high-rise residential developments taking place there.
Yeah, there's one in Elephant Castle as well, and I think it'll have to continue. There's some figures out from Telford, which is a relatively small house builder, but they've got a development pipeline. They build relatively what they call affordable or more affordable house flats in East London.
Stratford?
Yes, I
live in East London, yeah, and you can just, if you drive north from the Blackwall Tunnel, you just look at each side of the road, and where before it was just like industrial wasteland or whatever, I mean, just the flats are going up all the time. There's a huge amount from Stratford, and you pointed out kind of Bethnal Green Road, you know, Hackney.
And the brownfield legislation that was announced last week or earlier this week, that will have a significant effect as well. I mean, Telford, the sales for the year to March 2016 are going to be 3.5 times larger than last year.
Wow.
Which is huge.
Now, is this a continuation of the trend for overseas investors coming into the UK?
It's about a third. A third overseas investors, a third UK investors, and a third who actually want to live there.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's an interesting point. I think that there has been talk that this trend will fizzle out, but you know, the UK remains a safe haven. UK property remains a safe haven, certainly compared to some other assets that we can talk about. I don't see it coming to an end.
No, it won't fizzle out. I think it'll spread out because obviously, you know, you can't buy a flat in the West End unless you're rich. So you move out, and obviously, as infrastructure improves, transport improves, you know, you're going to end up living 15 miles out of London, but getting in 15 minutes on a new Crossrail or whatever.
Yeah, Crossrail's massive there. It's massively important, isn't it? Stratford will be on that.
Yeah, you know. Absolutely huge.
Mm. But it goes out nearly sort of halfway to me. It goes up to Shenfield, which is not far south.
No.
Southwest, in fact, of Orion.
Well, Shenfield's got good line anyway, but I mean, you go to somewhere like...
Are you sure about that?
Well, relatively. Used to be.
I don't think the punters of Greater Anglia would agree. Would they, Graham?
No.
Oh, used to be all right when I lived in...
Not these days, Jonas.
Not these days. No, Graham and I enjoy it. That line. It's terrible.
But Crossrail will go to Abbey Wood, which, even if you like Abbey Wood, you have to admit it's quite a depressed area. You can buy houses in Abbey Wood for $180,000, and that's where Crossrail will terminate.
And these are the kind of places you're thinking, well, if you're an aspiring buy-to-let landlord, can't afford some of the more salubrious postcodes, yeah, this is where you should be looking, where the transport, changing transport infrastructure can transform the investment case.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. And, of course, there's one last group, which I think is really interesting, students. I mean, this is a fascinating area. I mean, there's a... Actually, out in East London, sort of just past Liverpool Street, there's a huge student block there. I mean, these things, you know, these are better than most people's flats these days. But again, some of the changes to the student intake rules are really driving the case here, and there's ways you can play it as well.
Yeah. Well, the caps come off. I think it's from later this year or next year, entirely.
In terms of foreign students being able to come to the UK.
I've been around a couple of the new ones, and it's a bit like a hotel, really. Because there's a bar, canteen, restaurant, leisure areas, cinema, and all the students have their own cooking facilities, their induction cookers so they can't set fire to themselves, and they have laundry services. So if you're a sort of a 19-year-old foreign student and you don't know where you are, you can actually stay in these places without actually wandering out to the streets of Mile End and getting killed.
They're not that
by
bad.
Me.
All right, then. Led astray,
yeah. That
by me.
Yeah, so... And they're prepared to pay big bucks.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, as I said, they're lovely. I've seen them. It's amazing. My student gigs when I was at university were allegedly based on the design of a Swedish prison.
Ah, yes. No, that's not the first time I've heard that about student digs.
Yeah, I think
the
it's
halls
one of those,
residence.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure it's true. I think it's one of those.
They were pretty grim, though, weren't they?
They were grim. They were grim. I think everybody likes to think they stayed in a Swedish prison as a student. But it was pretty horrific. But so no, I mean it's a whole different ball game now. And there's ways you can play this trend. So we've got Unite.
Yeah, there's loads of them springing up.
GCP student living. Yeah. Really quite interesting. You know, Unite had a bit of a difficult time when it started out, but I think the wind has turned in its favour, and I think, you know.
Oh, very much so. I mean, obviously, at that time, financing was always going to be a problem because banks weren't prepared to lend anybody any money on a speculative basis. There were worries about, I mean, you know, because of the politics involved, you know, there were suggestions that if the right-wing element had their way, there wouldn't be any foreign students or only a very few. But obviously, it's gone the other way now. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they, as you say, they pay more.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we want.
Yeah,
big business.
And the rest of us can we can send our children to become plumbers and builders, and everybody's happy.
Exactly.
Lovely. Yep. Okay. Wonderful. Thank you, Joe. This is it's actually a really fascinating feature, and it's I think the way it's put together, you really get a feel for the way London's changing.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing, and it's
very,
changed
very much
significantly. Yeah, in the last few years, even, you know. Amazing. Thank you very much, Jonas. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. There's obviously plenty more in the magazine this week. We talked about consumer debt. Simon Thompson has written his column this week about car sales, which are obviously a big factor in that. Car markets are motoring along.
Motor finance doing incredibly well. SNU, which I mentioned earlier. Massive business.
Absolutely huge. So, yeah, if the car dealers are looking good too, Simon's having a look at that. We've got a couple of our no-thought portfolios in there. James Norrington's updated his high-yield portfolio, which is the ancient Investors Chronicle high-yield system, which actually seems to be working. Obviously, there's a lot of personal finance stuff in the magazine this week. We had a couple of reader requests this week to go into more detail about the new dividend tax changes that were announced in the summer budget. We've put a big piece together on that, but I'm sure they will talk about that on their podcast this week. Anyway, there you go. Capital Returns is the cover feature. A lovely picture of St Paul's, one of my favourite buildings. £4.50, all good news agents. And we will chat again next week. Thank you very much. Goodbye.